Welcome to Bible Study for Progressives, a show where moderates, liberals, and leftists of all faiths and ideologies come together to discuss scripture, spirituality, and politics. We engage scripture in its historical context, plumb its depths for wisdom and guidance, and apply its lessons to current events and social issues. Whether you're a liberal evangelical, a New Age spiritualist, a social justice activist, or a postmodern theologian, there's something in this show for you. Come, be energized in spirit and mind to understand the Word and what it means to be a spiritual person in today's world. Individual ideologies and theologies give us incomplete pictures of reality. The world is too complex. No ideology or theology can explain everything. Every ideology and every theology overlooks or misses something. There is always something that resists symbolization. This is the view of Slovenian philosopher Zolvog Zizek, who I have accessed primarily through a book called The End of Evangelicalism, Discerning a New Faithfulness for Mission Towards an Evangelical Political Theology by David E. Fitch. An interruption of the real occurs when someone takes the beliefs and tenets of his or her faith or ideology to the extreme. Jesus did this when he put his life on the line because he believed that the one and all-powerful God of Israel would save him, overthrow the rulers and authorities of this world, redeem and restore Israel to its rightful place among the nations, and take dominion over the world. The truth is suddenly revealed, often in a humiliating fashion, so that people are forced to confront the fact that what they thought would happen, what they believed, didn't come to pass, at least not as they expected. This is the story of the Gospels. The disciples expect the Messiah to be a victorious king who would defeat Israel's enemies. Something amazing did happen, but it wasn't what they expected. That something was the resurrection and the rise of the Jesus movement. Not all eruptions of the real are victorious as the resurrection. Most end in humiliation and the reexamination and reformulation of one's beliefs. Without the resurrection, Jesus' ministry would have ended the same way. Just another prophet and martyr killed by the authorities. But that's not what happened. Some of Jesus' followers, including Peter and James, had visions of Jesus after his death. This led them to believe that God had raised Jesus from the dead. In this article, we examine Fitch's concept of an eruption of the real and apply it to the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus of Nazareth. We will talk about Zizek's concepts of master signifiers and sublime objects and the role they play in motivating us to organize around ideologies and beliefs. Fitch, an evangelical himself, uses Zizek to demonstrate how some evangelical beliefs became disconnected from what they meant generations ago and now fail to serve God's mission in the world. Fitch points to the decline in the public perception of evangelicals to suggest that there is something wrong with evangelical witness in America. Some of his insights can be applied to Christianity more broadly. He says, there are reasons to suspect that our social presence as evangelicals has become inhospitable to the world and God's mission in it. Christians should reflect the gospel they preach. Evangelicalism has become an empty politic, driven by what we are against instead of what we are for, Fitch argues. Evangelical beliefs have turned evangelicals into something inconsistent with what they claim to believe. Fitch defines ideology and, in my opinion, its corollary, theology, as a set of beliefs and practices that bind a people together into a functioning community politic. In Marxist terms, ideology is that naive or false consciousness which constructs social reality for people. It is what people assume about the way things are and how these assumptions are maintained in order to sustain the system. Our political and social systems are composed of institutions, rituals, social norms, and even language itself. Zizek calls this the symbolic order. The symbolic order is a type of groupthink that shapes who we are and our life together. It appeals to our desires and insecurities. Political systems are held together by ideologies and theologies. All political and theological systems are founded upon the story of some early trauma that tells us who we are and what and who we are for or against. Ideology and theology hold us together by covering over social antagonisms and internal contradictions, oftentimes by setting us against others. The religious and political beliefs that identify us as part of a religious or political group are what Zizek and others have called master signifiers. Master signifiers bind a community together by aligning them for or against something. They are sufficiently vague to play into people's desires, and they create a fantasy around which people can rally without actually referring to anything concrete. Every ideology or theology provides a fantasy that allows people to act as if we all believe the same thing when in reality we don't. People do not believe in things like freedom or God in the same way. Yet it is this very nebulous character that allows us to act as if we believe the same thing. Things like the kingdom of God to Christians, the socialist utopia to Marxists, and the free market to capitalists are vague fantasies around which people rally, yet they have no real meaning except to signify who and what we are for or against. Master signifiers are more about the antagonisms that underlay our social relations than they are about any ideal or plan of action. Zizek calls this the real. The only things that are real are the antagonisms that the ideology or theology covers over and misdirects, often against some feared or loathsome other. For socialists, the other could be the dreaded neoliberals, or the capitalist-loving property owners Marx called the bourgeoisie. For capitalists, the boogeyman are financial regulations and the rise of the working class. The scapegoats for evangelical Christians are those they consider to be morally degenerate, such as homosexuals and liberals. These false beliefs can cause believers to be complicit with brutal and exploitative systems of domination, such as totalitarian regimes, fascist dictatorships, racist institutions, and theocracies. Each of these systems uses ideologies and theologies to justify their existence and to explain why they continue on their economic or political course. Using Kant's concept of the sublime, Zizek describes ideology as vastly more powerful than we can perceive or understand objectively. Under the influence of ideologies, the beliefs and ideas we rally around and pursue together become unobtainable, sublime objects. We feel great pleasure lusting after them, and their allure holds us captive to the ideology. Things like the party in some communist regimes, God in theocracies, and freedom in democracies are all master signifiers elevated to the level of sublime objects. No one can really pin them down, yet everyone under the influence of the ideology is said to believe in them. The concepts are nebulous enough so that many people can believe in their own way, yet powerful enough to rally an entire people around a unifying fantasy. For Zizek, fundamental antagonisms lie at the core of every political system. For example, the ideology of capitalism covers over the inequality between the poor workers and the rich elite they work for by promoting the idea of freedom. These antagonisms are the only things that are real in the system. Fitch goes on to describe what he calls an eruption of the real. An eruption of the real occurs when excessive fealty to an ideology reveals the underlying antagonisms and emptiness of the ideology. Eruptions of the real are like tears in the political fabric that reveal too much so as to pave the way for further unraveling. Another, perhaps overly simplistic way of saying it, is that an eruption of the real is that moment of truth when everyone realizes that the emperor has no clothes. These awkward events reveal the absurdity of what we say we believe by revealing the contradictions and underlying antagonisms behind the ideology or theology that upholds the system. Eruptions of the real can make room for revolutionary change. Ironically, these eruptions are not instigated by those who oppose the system. They are instead caused by those who take their ideology or theology too seriously. Ideology is immune to overt criticism, says Zizek. Every ideology has already internalized its own critique. Outside criticism merely affords the ideology the opportunity to recreate itself. As such, an ideology can only be overthrown from within. This is exactly what Zizek suggests we do. Take the ideology or theology to the extreme to reveal its absurdity. This is called the tactic of over-identification, or subversive conformity. Only total conformity can make explicit the implications of the ideology and reveal the emptiness at its core. Political systems are inherently unstable. Eruptions of the real happen all the time. Works of art, cinema, or poetry can reveal the absurdity of what we say we believe. There can also be unintentional eruptions when an adherent takes the ideology too far or too literally, thereby exposing the contradictions, antagonisms, and lack underlying the ideology. Eruptions of the real expose the contradictions at the center of our politics. They reveal that which is left unsaid, what or who is being excluded, and what drives the system. Eruptions of the real expose the sources and forces behind the ideology's continued dominance. Zizek would describe these moments of truth as decisive revolutionary acts. An ideology can lose its hold over people, and new leaders can emerge who more directly engage the system's depravity and lack. This can only happen from within the movement. An eruption is a forcible or violent invasion or uprising from within, as opposed to an eruption, which is a bursting out. Ideologies collapse from within. By taking the ideology to its logical conclusion, we reveal the contradictions and emptiness at its core. Jesus took Judaism seriously, so seriously that he went to the cross believing God would save him. In the Gospel of Matthew, the chief priests and elders ridiculed Jesus for trusting God. He thought God would save him, but look where it got him, hanging on a tree, dying, cursed by God. There is more than a little irony when priests ridicule those who trust in God. Just as Jesus breathes his last, Matthew tells us, the curtain of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom. The earth shook and the rocks were split. The tombs also were opened, and many bodies of the saints who had fallen asleep were raised. After his resurrection, they came out of the tombs and entered the holy city and appeared to many. Now when the centurion and those with him who were keeping watch over Jesus saw the earthquake and what took place, they were terrified and said, "Truly, this man was God's son." In other words, there was an incredible eruption that shook the earth. The tombs of the saints were opened, and the bodies of the dead arose and entered the holy city. Even the centurion, the one most indoctrinated by Roman imperial dogma, could see the truth. The imagery represents an unveiling of the contradictions at the core of Roman imperial theology and the collapse of that system. The resurrection represents victory over the powers. The crucifixion looks at first like humiliation, and then something amazing happens. The movement is reborn. Some of Jesus' followers have experiences of the risen Christ. This leads some of them to believe that Jesus had been raised from the dead. This inspires stories of the resurrection as God's vindication. The true ruler of the world is among us in the form of the Son of Man, which is an idiom for humanity. Our leaders ought to serve us, not the other way around. Our system and the ideology that supports it tells us that the competition of interest groups ultimately leads to a compromise that best suits us all. This is not the biblical way. Rather than represent our interest, the gospel tells us to change our priorities. We are to proclaim good news to the poor, release to prisoners, and set the oppressed free. We are to bring down the powerful, lift up the lowly, feed the hungry, and send the rich away empty. We are to distribute our resources based on need and share everything in common, just as early Christians did. Have I gone too far? Have I taken the gospel too seriously? Too literally? I hope so. Before we turn to our discussion, let's hear from Professor Joseph Dow.
Hi, Richard. I've included comments on a variety of topics relevant to your article. I should say up front that although I'm a philosophy professor, I'm not an expert on Slavoj Žižek. And I should perhaps note that Žižek's approach to philosophy is very different from the dominant approach in English-speaking countries. There are two main branches of Western philosophy. On one hand, there's analytic philosophy, which predominates in English-speaking countries. On the other hand, there's continental European philosophy. Analytic philosophy emphasizes logic and clarity, almost to the exclusion of all else, whereas continental philosophy operates with less of a logical straitjacket, let's say. I'm trained in the analytic tradition, while Žižek is trained in the continental tradition, so I'm probably not the best person to summarize his thought, but I'll do my best to provide some information. If you want to understand Žižek's thought, it's essential to understand one of his intellectual heroes, the 20th century French psychoanalyst Jacques Lacan, who drew on Sigmund Freud's theories. Lacan's theories are complex, and I can't claim to understand most of them myself. But here are some Lacanian ideas that might help us better understand what Žižek is saying. When a child, let's say a boy, is born, he's largely uncoordinated, lacks control over his own body, and thus lacks a sense of himself as a unified whole. All this changes when the child first recognizes his image in a reflection, at least according to Lacan. According to Lacan, this reflection of the child's body, provides the child with an image of himself as a unified whole. This reflection becomes the child's original self-image. The child then modifies his self-image by attaching various signifiers to the reflection. A signifier is a word. For example, the child might take the words that he hears people use when talking about him and attach those words to his self-image. The self-image that a person has later in life has evolved from this original mere image, the reflection of himself that the child saw. Because a child's self-image is ultimately formed from a literal visual image, a reflection, the person's self-image belongs to the realm of sensory experiences. Lacan calls sensory experiences the imaginary order. Anyway, back to our child. The child starts out seeing his main caregiver, let's say his mother, as an omnipotent power and as the only other thing in the universe. But soon he notices that the mother doesn't lavish all her attention on him. So he comes to believe that he's not getting unconditional love from the mother, that some other object of desire diverts the mother's love from him. The child guesses that someone or something else, let's say the father, has this wonderful object that's pulling away the mother's love from the child. Now, Lacan thinks that the unconscious works like a language. When the unconscious part of our minds processes words, it connects them with each other using wordplay, metaphor, and so on. For example, a dream that's really about a fear of bugs might include someone who is constantly annoying you, since another word for annoy is bug. Instead of saying, you're annoying me, you could say, you're bugging me. So when the unconscious part of our mind goes to work constructing a dream that's supposed to be about fear of bugs, it might replace the bugs with someone who is bugging you. Lacan thinks that the same kind of process happens when the child identifies the father as having a magical object that pulls the mother away. For the child's unconscious, the father's name comes to stand for that magical object. By the way, the main caregiver doesn't have to be a literal mother, and the bearer of the magical object doesn't have to be a literal father. This is just an example. So the father's name now stands for the magic object that diverted the mother's attention from the child. As you can see, we're getting pretty Freudian here. Anyway, the father's name now stands for that magical object. But the child eventually realizes that the father himself doesn't have the magical object. This magical object will continue to haunt the child throughout his life. He will still want to possess the magical object. Or, to put it differently, he will still long for the unconditional maternal love that he felt was stolen from him. Lacan thinks that whenever we desire something, a house, a job, a partner, we are really seeking the magic object. In other words, he thinks that whenever we desire something, again, money, fame, new shoes, whenever we desire something, really what we're doing is we're longing for that unconditional love that we had when we were infants and that we felt was stolen from us. We're trying to fill that void in us with something else. Now, the father's name is a word, so it's part of what Lacan calls the symbolic order. The symbolic order is the realm of language. Because language is the foundation of social structures can also be considered part of the symbolic order. The father's name is the most important part of the symbolic order because Lacan thinks that in the child's unconscious, the father's name comes to stand for the whole symbolic order. So, we have the imaginary order, that is, the realm of sensory experience, and we have the symbolic order, the realm of language. But for Lacan, there's a third realm, which he calls the real. Remember, Lacan thinks that a person's language determines the kinds of thoughts that the person can have. For example, if you don't have a certain word that exists in another language, you might not be able to have all of the same thoughts that someone in that other language can have. Okay. Now, sometimes we encounter something that doesn't make sense to us because it doesn't fit into the framework of our language. Again, at least according to Lacan. Now that's the real. The real consists of those events and experiences where thought breaks down. Or, since the symbolic order is the realm of language, we might say that the real consists of those events and experiences where the symbolic order breaks down. There's a lot of disagreement about what exactly the real is in Lacan's thought. Zizek thinks that the real is not something that causes the symbolic order to break down, but rather the breakdown itself. He thinks the real is just the breakdown of the symbolic order. The real consists of all the contradictions and antagonisms within the symbolic order. That is, within language and the social systems built on language. An eruption of the real, then, would be a moment when those contradictions and antagonisms are revealed. In this sense, Jesus' death was indeed an eruption of the real. The political and religious elites put an innocent man to death, revealing the contradiction at the heart of the system. the Roman Empire, which had brought political peace and unity to the Mediterranean world, had done so through violence and persecution. Jesus' death laid bare this violence and persecution, revealing the contradiction of the so-called Pax Romana. Before I end, I'd like to add my own example of an eruption of the real, namely the strong support for Donald Trump's presidential campaign among evangelical Christians. What's surprising isn't that many conservative evangelicals maintained their party loyalty and voted Republican. Rather, what's surprising is the intensity of evangelical support for Trump. Given his past and his lifestyle, Trump has absolutely zero credibility as a supporter of traditional family values or anything like that. So why on earth would conservative evangelicals support him? Now, it's tempting to dismiss these evangelicals as hypocrites, but I think that Trump-supporting evangelicals are best seen not as hypocrites, but as an eruption of the real, a revelation of contradictions and antagonisms that have always been present within conservative American evangelicalism. In their eagerness to defend religious conservatism, some conservative evangelicals have nearly identified evangelicalism with political conservatism, to the point where they would throw religious conservatism under the bus in order to support whatever or whoever seems most politically reactionary. The evangelical Trump movement did exactly that, revealing the contradictions at the heart of conservative American evangelicalism. I'd like to end by pointing out that this isn't just a problem for conservative evangelicals. There are contradictions and antagonisms within every society. And, you know, since this is called Bible Study for Progressives, I might point out that there are certainly many contradictions and antagonisms lurking within the ideology. I should point out that there are definitely some contradictions and antagonisms lurking within the ideology of a lot of my fellow progressives, especially those who are fairly affluent and comfortable. This isn't just a problem for evangelicals. There are contradictions and antagonisms within every society. Now, the word apocalypse literally means uncovering. And so I would say that the church's calling is to be a perpetual apocalypse, uncovering the contradictions and antagonisms within any society, including the church itself.
Now let's turn to our discussion. I have with me today, I should introduce everybody, Professor Westfall and the Reverend Carl Procida, and myself, Rich Procida. So have I taken the gospel too far? Has my extremism about the gospel opened your eyes? I mean, either today or throughout this time? How so? If not, why not?
I think Fitch has really nailed down some really important issues. And he talks about these three places here where he sees these problems. One is the idea of inerrancy of Scripture. Another is the idea that somehow America is a Christian nation. And the other is the idea that just getting people to come to church or evangelistic meetings or something, and they come up and go forward and pray a prayer, and all of a sudden they're Christians. These are all good examples of things that Christianity is kind of putting too much emphasis on. The inerrancy is really an overreaction to the idea that there are some controversial things in the Bible. And so we say, hey, it's all perfect, it's all good, it's all from God. And so instead of, thinking these things through a little bit, just, circle the wagons and defend it at any cost. The idea of a Christian nation really is a response to secularization. And just if we could go back and have prayer in schools, and whose prayers, what kind of prayers, things like that, that's just not the issue. It's just kind of a symbol here that people latch on to. And the idea of decisional salvation, that's another one. It's kind of an easy way out. I was teaching, involved working with a group of fourth through sixth grade students here in a Sunday school class. And the students got the idea when they brought a friend in here to the group that one of the adults in there could, quote unquote, save them. Okay. And the idea was go forward and have somebody say a prayer. And now, bingo, you are all okay. And, you know, had absolutely no effect on the kids. Okay. The kids were the same before as they were afterwards. But somehow it gave the impression here that something was really positive, was really happening, you know, even if it wasn't. I had a pastor one time, and he was saying something, and he used the phrase evangelically speaking. And the idea of evangelically speaking was kind of exaggerating things, okay? It was just kind of a code word inside the fraternity here that we're kind of exaggerating things to look better. And so anyway, I very much relate to what Fitch is saying here about that. I do think that all three of these things are problems. I think that these things, you carry them out to the logical extreme and so forth, they create a lot more problems than they solve. I don't think they actually solve any problems. It just diverts attention away from what the real problem is.
Yeah. Fitch talks about those three things, the Christian nation, the decision for Christ, and the inerrant Bible. And he says that the belief in the inerrant Bible sets Christians up for arrogance and exclusion. And the decision for Christ makes Christians duplicitous, and that the belief that the United States is a Christian nation leads Christians to be dispassionate toward and complicit with injustice. So these are the, what do you think about that?
I actually heard, the guy was a fundamentalist, okay, but one time he said, yeah, somebody asked him if the United States was a Christian nation, and he said, nah, he said, it's a heathen nation run by the devil, okay, but it wasn't what he wasn't really saying here, now the United States isn't a Christian nation. What he was really saying was that his particular brand of fundamentalism was pretty much the only way to go, so you're coming to a position of arrogance and so forth, and self-righteousness and all that. So he really wasn't denying that it was a Christian nation. He was just saying, hey, we're doing a better job than the mainline churches up the street.
Yeah. So, Dad, can you see how maybe sometimes a belief in an inerrant Bible might make Christians arrogant, and then they want to exclude people, and then how the decision for Christ might result in Christians being duplicitous, or like they don't want to, or they think that this is all they need to be perfect, and that people who don't believe the same way maybe, or that they don't have to change their behavior or their way of life or do anything to be a Christian. They just make a decision and then they just go on the same way. And then the idea of the Christian nation, that if we think we're a Christian nation, then we better take responsibility as Christians for what the nation does. Is there any alternative to ideologies and beliefs? I mean, I don't know if there's an alternative. Is Isaac just helping us be aware of the power and insidiousness of our beliefs and ideologies and theologies?
If you want to press that issue, postmodernism and everything, you come around to the fact that they don't believe that you can nail down any kind of theories or any kind of beliefs to truth, I'm shocked that you took that position, but because I don't think that any a group of people living together has to have a coherent ethic. They have to have a metaphysical point of view that there is a God who is creator of this world, and that has made allowances for us to have an eternal future for each of us. And so I don't think that that's dysfunctional. I think that that's healthy, and it's psychologically sound for people to believe that, that there's a God who is in charge of this this world.
Well, Zizek is obviously an atheist, but I don't, whether, but I guess I'm wondering, is there an alternative to having any beliefs?
I do think, and I've been actually talking with our pastors and youth pastors and so forth about these issues, because a lot of people are beginning to really notice here that we're losing maybe 80% of our youth, the people who are raised up in church and so forth, and they get up and they go on to college and they get disconnected from where they were, and they pretty much, most of them never show up, an awful lot of them don't ever show up in a church again, or only on very, very rare occasions. Okay? And I think part of the problem here, somebody actually wrote a good book on the, part of some material on this, but one of the issues here is that an awful lot of what's done in churches comes down with the idea, hey, there's just one way to look at this. And if you look at Christianity, okay, and the different flavors and varieties of Christianity, there are a lot of different ways of looking at these things. And if you show people that there are different ways of looking at these things, if some way doesn't really work terribly well for them, there's another way to approach this issue. And so you don't have to make it an all or none type thing. Go along with everything we say, or my way to the highway. So I think that's one very important thing. I think another thing that people can do and don't do a lot in church is the whole idea of spiritual formation. I'm talking about young people, but I think this is something that kind of, you know, is kind of an underrepresentative, underemphasized thing, okay, where you're talking about people, Bible study, prayer, okay, doing good works consciously and so forth. Not just being Christian as an identification, but making Christianity a lifestyle, okay, getting involved with it. There's an old saying here, you know, the Catholics use this frequently. This is, I am a practicing Catholic, okay, I am a practicing Christian, okay. If you make an effort to live out your faith, you're going to be in a lot better position, and you're not as likely to get distracted by some of these superficial things here that everybody gets all so excited about. Just a lot of commotion, not too much substance. Yeah.
I think it's important for us to recognize how beliefs and ideologies function and how they can sometimes mislead us or set us against people and make us feel like, like for instance, if you tell somebody that you're Christian, and then the next thing you know, they start bashing gays in front of you, or they start talking about their Republican policies or something. They just make assumptions that when you say you're a Christian, that you automatically believe all these terrible things. And so there's sort of a function of ideologies, and I'm not sure if I go with Zizek's that it's completely empty, that ideology is completely meaningless. And but one thing he's trying to do is help people come to moments of truth. The moment of truth is that, well, like the example, I think I gave a speech at the Poor People's Campaign. And the moment of truth is really when we realize that what this is really just about interest group. The interest of the group, or people are having these ideologies, but what's behind them is that antagonism. And I'll talk about the speech I gave where I talked about how white men should step up white progressive men should step up and should be free to speak and be fully engaged in the movement. But there's this nationwide idea that white middle-aged men should step back and let colored people step up. And that's what's behind that. It's not really a functional approach because you need everybody speaking up. There's really no scarcity of freedom of expression. There's no shortage of free speech. And what you need is more people speaking out, more people rising up. But what's behind this this ideology is some idea that, oh, well, we just, it's the interest thing again. We're buying into the American idea that white progressive males are inevitably going to pursue white people's interests. They're not going to be aware of what colored people go through. But what we don't realize is that the anger and antagonisms that black people and colored people feel against white Americans is really what's coming out here. And it's not an ideology that makes any sense when it comes down to it, because it doesn't serve anybody, because there's no restrictions on people's ability to speak. We need everybody speaking up. And there isn't a whole lot of truth that progressive white males are somehow going to come out and take conservative positions. We need them. So what's real about that ideology is that colored people are angry and they feel betrayed and they feel that when white people come in, they don't have their interest at heart. And that's what's driving the ideology, not the internal consistency of the ideology, but the anger and contentiousness that is there. And so if we can realize that when we go to church and we talk about how we believe all these things, how much is it our own personal fears and desires that are being served and by the ideology, and rather than the actual substance of the ideology itself?
Hey, there's things are always more complicated than people really say, you know. And I'm speaking here as a white male, for whatever it's worth. But, you know, Bernie Sanders was echoing some of the things that you were saying, you know. I'm a white man and so forth. But he came down with it. He says, I'm elderly, you know. So now he had kind of a group identification here. You know, old people tend to get oppressed and so forth. And it actually happens. Okay, I get people calling me every day or trying to rip me off, telemarketers and so forth. So
you can see how powerful that ideology you mentioned is, where Bernie Sanders has to now conform to the ideology in some way and make up some reason why he should be listened to. And my question is, why should I come out as anything just to be listened to, just because as a human being, just to be listened to? Do I have to come out as something? I mean, I could. I mean, what if that's just something that I want to keep to myself and not something I want to throw out to the world? I saw Trevor Noah on The Daily Show hit him up with just the same question. You're a white man. Why shouldn't you step back? And so we can see how that operates. And then when I was giving, I can see some people really, really angry, incredibly angry. And they would come up and I was introducing speakers. So they might come up and hand a mic to something else or say something like, yeah, you can preach, but do you really, have you ever done anything to help the poor? You know, in other words, there was incredible tension. So, and it goes all, so now we've got this guy who's ahead in our presidential campaign being criticized by progressives who need him to win or to do a good showing at least for being an old white man. So there's a way that ideologies can become dysfunctional and unhelpful. And I think that's what Fitch is kind of pointing out, that sometimes beliefs are not helpful. I think, and Fitch describes the development of evangelicalism, that it came out of the modernist controversy, the modernist, I forget what that's called, but the, and really evangelicalism doesn't develop until the 1950s in response to the social gospel. Is that right? The social gospel was the...
Yes.
Yeah, in response to the social gospel. So what's the antagonism here? The antagonism is that evangelicals don't think that we should do what the social gospel people think the gospel is calling them to do. And so they came up with this decision of Christ so they can avoid the more progressive and liberal churches who felt that there was a social gospel, that we were to help the poor, lift up the lowly, all those things I talked about, be involved in social issues and political issues. And so that's where evangelicalism really came from. It came as an opposition to a more social gospel, to the development of modern history and modernism.
Hey, do you look at the kind of development of things historically? The Anabaptists were a kind of a reaction here to the state churches. Okay, so first you had the Catholic Church, and if you're born in the Catholic country, then you were baptized as a baby and you were a Catholic. And then we had the Protestant Reformation came along, and then it just basically splits up. This country is Protestant, that's Catholic, and so forth and so on. But they took the same pattern, okay? You're born into Germany, Lutheranism was the state church, you were born there, and you were baptized as a baby, and now you're a good Lutheran and a German citizen, okay? And the Anabaptists thought, no, people are too young here, they don't know what's going on at all, somebody's pouring some water on them, and that's it. They thought that people should choose on their own to become Christians. And so that's kind of the start of the decisional salvation thing.
This has been Bible Study for Progressives. If you enjoyed the program, please subscribe to our podcast or put us in your favorites and write a 5-star review. Tell your friends about us and share us on social media. Follow us on Facebook and click the donate button at modernlectionaries.blogspot.com. Your support will help us reach more people, produce more and better shows, and cover the cost of production. Feel free to send me a note or comment on the show. I would love to hear from you. Until next time, this is Rich Procida. Thank you for listening.